Okay, all right, well, yeah. Hello, everyone, and it's very nice to be starting here. It seems like a lovely place with lovely artwork everywhere, and yeah. Okay. People are more complex than art. You've got to get to know them. This is lovely. Okay. Right, so yeah, today I'm going to be talking about some work I did with my old PhD supervisor, John March Russell at Oxford, and another of his students, Isabel, about dark matter in twin Higgs models. The talk will basically be, I'll go through some of the sort of motivation for and structure of twin Higgs models, and then talk about the cosmological consequences of some simple, minimal versions of those. So, just in time.
Yes.
Okay. So, start off with, as in a lot of these types of talks, a very, very quick overview of the hierarchy problem. Okay, so, basic idea is that we have quadratically divergent contributions to the mass squared of the standard model Higgs. So the biggest one, if we're just looking at standard model contributions coming from the top loop. So you get something that goes as the top coupling squared times the scale of new physics squared, where we could take this as new physics being some kind of compositeness at some scale, lambda. If you have You might have other contributions if you have other types of new physics. This is parametrically roughly what you'd expect from that kind of new physics. Okay, so, and the solution that sort of is most familiar and most popular is something like the supersymmetric one, where you cancel off this contribution with new supersymmetric particles, which also couple with the Higgs. So you're going to, the quadratic contribution gets contribution from the top, and also from the stop, those are set, the coupling set by supersymmetry should be equal, so quadratic divergence goes away. You still have log parts, and that will still give you some kind of need to have the scale of new physics small enough, but okay. So the problem with a lot of supersymmetric solutions and others is that if you do have standard model charge top partners, especially colored ones, then in many situations, those should already have been seen at collider experiments. So the LHC is currently taking big bites out of the parameter space for supersymmetric particles and will continue to do so. A possible solution to this issue is that, well, can we have something where we cancel off the quadratic divergences but with standard model neutral particles. And what we're going to be looking at as an example of this, twin Higgs theory. So the sort of buzzword here is neutral naturalness. So the goal here is we're not going to remove all quadratically divergent contributions to the Higgs mass squared, like in supersymmetry, where you have some big symmetry that kills off everything. But we're just going to try and make the sort of numerical factor here smaller than you get from the standard model contribution, so that we can still have, we can have new physics a bit higher than we'd otherwise needed to have it, and still have an acceptable level of tuning. So yeah, so we're going to try and solve, that's in the sense of little, solving the little hierarchy problem. We're not going to try to have some symmetry that deals with everything all the way up to some arbitrary high scale. We're going to try and make numerically the value of the tuning smaller. Okay, so the general, so I'm going to present this sort of a fairly rough overview, but the general idea in twin Higgs theories is that we're going to have two doublets, this is where the name twin Higgs is coming from, and at the start we're going to impose exchange symmetry between them. So if you had, just writing down the potential for that, we'd have the quadratic part and then some quartic part, and this part is SU, well actually SO8, but SU4 invariant. So it by itself in the HAHB plane would be rotationally invariant. If kappa is small, we get this small correction to that. So, and then if our A and B Higgs couple to separate, say, Fermi tops, so a top and a top prime, then again, we get quadratic corrections to the mass squared of these things. We get the coupling of the Higgs A to the top, coupling the Higgs B to the top prime, and those, and then the usual log things. And then the point here, this is the sort of point of the twin Higgs mechanism, is that if you have these couplings equal to each other, then the quadratic part of the potential is still symmetric. It still has the form of an HA squared plus HB squared term. So that means that we still have this symmetric, we still have this general sort of rotational symmetry between these two parts. And so that means if the symmetry breaking term, this kappa, is small, then we have pseudo-Nambo-Goldstone bosons for the breaking of this, so seven of those, with small mass, with mass squares which are small by this kappa parameter. And then...
Yes. So in those theories, after you construct the whole thing,
yep.
Is kappa naturally small if you... So running the RGEs back and forth, is it reasonable to pick up small?
Well, so we're going, in the end, we're going to need kappa to be about the standard model Higgs-Cortic coupling. So that is going, it's going to give a contribution to that and then plus some log stuff. But naturally, it's going to be about that level. So about sort of an eighth or so. So if, yeah, so if lambda is not too small and kappa is parametrically a bit smaller, then we get, so the correction to the... lambda f squared here, so that's setting the sort of mass, not setting the verb here, that gets quadratic corrections, which is set by the coupling to the top squared, if these are both equal. But then, since the mass of the pseudo-Nambo-Goldstone bosons is set by kappa times this, if kappa is bigger than lambda, we've numerically won a bit, and that's the idea. So if we have lambda sort of one-ish, and kappa of an eighth or so, we win by that kind of factor. That's the general plan. Okay, and so as you might expect from the whole thing with a top and a top prime, we're going to identify one of the sectors, say the A sector with the standard model, and we're going to identify the B sector with some standard model neutral twin sector. So we've got, like I said, seven pseudo-Nambo-Goldstone bosons, and three of those are going to get eaten by a standard model electroweak. Standard model SU2, three of those are going to get eaten by twin SU2, and then that leaves one as our physical light Higgs. And in, if we're looking at this way, then that would be in this direction. We'd have a heavy radial mode, which would be our heavy Higgs with mass of order F squared. You could also view this as a sort of nonlinear sigma model. This is the sort of linear completion of it. Okay, but this Z2 symmetric version has a problem. The light Higgs is in this direction, the pseudo-Goldstone mode is in this direction, i.e. equally A and B sectors. So that would mean that it would have equal couplings to the SU2A and the SU2B gauge bosons, which is not like the Higgs that we see. The Higgs that we see has standard model-like couplings to within 10% or so. So in order to get that right, we need to tune the symmetry breaking part of potential, the part that's not Z2 symmetric between HA and HB, to make the light Higgs mostly in the standard model direction. So we need to make it so that our thing is, our vacuum is there and it's in that direction. So, and that requires a tune it. So yes, so we need to have a standard model Higgs, standard model electroweak bev, much smaller than the twin sector one. And this is the part where we have some extra tuning coming in. So we'd require to tune of about this order, so standard model VEV squared over the twin VEV squared. And Higgs coupling measurements mean that our new VEV has to be about three times standard model VEV, which corresponds to roughly a 20% or so tuning. So, and this would mean that we do actually get some small modifications to the couplings of our physical light Higgs. So the standard model couplings are modified by cos of this, the couplings of the twin sector are sine of that. So we do have that signal, but It's small enough that we wouldn't have seen it yet. But generically, yeah, that's one of the signals you'd expect to see from twin Higgs models, modified Higgs couplings, with a fairly definite relation to the kind of tuning that you have to give. Okay, so in this talk, we're going to be focusing on a particular subset of twin Higgs models, in a certain sense, the minimal version that you can get away with doing and still solve the little hierarchy problem on some level. Okay, so the thing that we were talking about earlier was getting rid of the quadratic divergent top loop corrections by having the couplings to the top, the Higgs to the top and the twin top be the same. And if you want to, if we're looking at a cutoff of around 5 TeV and you want that to give a contribution of the Higgs mass squared that's not too big, then the fractional difference in these couplings has got to be less than about the percent level. So that's the first part. You've also got Higgs mass corrections from gauge boson loops, both the SU2 standard model electroweak, this is what standard model SU2, and the twin SU2. If you look at that again, then these need to be the same on about the 10% level at the lambda scale or so. And it also turns out that the QCD corrections, if you look at top loop plus plus the gluon, also big enough, the standard model part is big enough that you want to cancel it off if you're not going to have too big a contribution to the Higgs mass squared. So you want a twin QCD with a coupling that is of order, again, 10%-ish similar to standard model QCD. The corrections you get from hypercharge from the standard model are actually a bit sort of order or a bit smaller than the Higgs mass squared for the kind of cutoffs we're considering here. So in the minimal version, you wouldn't actually need to cancel that off. That's an acceptable kind of level of correction. Okay, so given that you need to make those corrections, you need to actually cancel off those corrections, the minimal kind of structure we need is, so a twin top, that was the most important thing, with a coupling that is about 1% close to the standard model top. We needed twin SU2 prime gauge bosons with a coupling that was about 10%, within 10% of the standard model ones. That also means that we need a twin bottom quark as a doublet partner of the twin top quark, as the left-handed version. And then, if we're only going to have one generation of these things, we need what we're going to call a twin lepton doublet, just another SU2 prime doublet to cancel the Witten anomaly. We then decided that we'd also need twin SU3 primed, so twin QCD, and the fact that the coupling needed to be within 15% or so means that once you work it all through for a cutoff of about 5 TeV, you need the confinement scale to be 0.5 GeV to 20 GeV or so. And then we need to put in a twin the right quark to cancel the SU3 anomaly. So we have basically a copy of one standard model generation with SU2 prime, SU3 prime, couplings which are sufficiently similar, and then that's the minimum, and that's what's being called the fraternal twin Higgs. So not exact, what do you call exact twins? There's a different word, there's a science word. Sorry?
Identical?
Yeah, identical, but there's a Latin thing, I don't remember. Anyway, fraternal being, so not the same, but just sufficiently similar enough. So in particular, as long as the Yukawa couplings of the other fermions that we have to introduce, the B prime, the tau prime, and the neutrino prime, are small enough, then we don't really care what they are.
Well, you're going to explain the coincidence of coupling and some of that in terms of some symmetry breaking?
You're just
replacing
one
by another.
So this is a sort of bottom-up version. The question of where this kind of symmetry structure comes from is a question of the sort of UV completion of these models. There are...
Oh, that's true, but at the level of achieving what you want to start. I mean, the coincidence you have right now are multiplicative, right? So you have three things that you need. One of them has to be a percent level, the other two have to be 10% level. Altogether, it's at a level of 10 to minus 4.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So the idea is you have some kind of Z approximate Z2 symmetry between these sectors.
Okay.
That's where that's coming from. So these this is actually the symmetric point.
Is this problematic if you don't have the other two?
If you don't have the other two?
Family. Because here you assume you only have the third family, right? So if you don't have
the
other
thing, I think the problem is the photon, right? That you don't want to have a light particle around.
Oh, no, no, but the whole point is we didn't actually need to introduce a hypercharge
here.
So we
but if you had a Z2 symmetry...
Oh, yeah, so, okay. So how you would have some Z2 symmetry that does this and doesn't populate a mirror copy of the standard model with exactly the same other generations, exactly the same photon or whatever, that is a separate question. There are attempts to do this kind of thing. I don't think anything overly convincing. The sort of philosophy behind this particular minimal case is that this is the sort of minimal particle content that you would need to see in order for the cancellation procedure to work. If you're looking at it from a symmetry point of view, then you might think the minimal thing is actually just a full mirror. And yes, people have looked at that as well. So yeah, that's...
Because it's a hard breaking of the Z2 symmetry, right?
In order not to have a second generation, in order,
or if you have the fault. I mean, all these things are hard breaking of the symmetry. It's not the soft breaking of the symmetry. So in principle, it's not obvious that.
So no, I'm not going to try and say that this philosophy is better than, or in some sense, in some philosophical sense, more minimal than just mirroring it.
I don't think it's philosophical because it affects the existence, affects the running, and.
Okay. You understand the rules of the game?
Yes, so so we're playing with the rules of minimal particle content here. And yeah, so certainly realizing this in models where you actually have some kind of symmetry that does all this, separate question.
I don't think we're thinking about models.
Yes, nothing overly useful, just convincing to say. That's the wrap of the situation. Anyway, but we're going to look at the consequences of this one as a minimal sort of thing. And certainly, though, variations you can go, and the mirror case is also interesting. Okay, so in terms of signatures, as the sort of goal, the twin states are standard model neutral. We only have interactions through the Higgs portal, so the LHC production rates for these things are low. The kind of signatures you'd expect, so Higgs coupling modifications, but by construction, if the twin BEV is sufficiently larger, then those wouldn't have been seen so far. The other signature that people have looked at is possible displaced decays of twin strong states, so twin mesons, twin glue balls, kind of hidden valley phenomenology you might get from those. That's an interesting topic, but we will not investigate that for this talk. We'll instead be looking at the cosmological consequences of this kind of model. Okay, so firstly, the question is, well, what kind of stable states might we expect from this? So the twin baryon number, B primed, is an accidental symmetry of our model, and the lightest B prime carrying state we'd expect to be, so in the case where the twin bottom is significantly lighter than the twin top, which we do need to have in order not to have an extra tuning there. So effectively you've got one very, very heavy thing and one lighter quark. So you'd expect the lightest twin B prime carrying state is the equivalent of the delta baryon, so three Bs together.
It's not the glue ball?
That would be a zero baryon number.
The lightest baryon, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
so no, it won't be the lightest strong state, necessarily.
Yes, this is what I'm asking,
But it will be the lightest one that carries twin baryon number. Okay, and so, again, for simplicity, for now, we'll assume that the twin charge, where we take the obvious equivalent of the standard model charge, is a good symmetry, even if we don't have a gauged U1 prime. You can get rid of that assumption and have different consequences. This makes things simpler on a first analysis. So then, assuming that your nu and your tau, so our lepton doublet, are sufficiently light, so then we have the tau prime will be the lightest that should be q primed, the lightest twin charge state. And then We also have that the twin lepton number will be an accidental symmetry in this case, so the twin neutrino, if we're going to call that the lighter one, will be the lightest L prime carrying state. So like the standard model, we'd have baryons, charged leptons, and neutrinos as being stable due to accidental symmetries there. In the situation where we just have a heavy top and a lighter twin bottom, we don't have a quark flavor symmetry like we do in the standard model that gives us pions or whatever. So we don't have parametric twin QCD states that are parametrically lighter than the twin confinement scale. In particular, we'd expect that twin mesons or glue balls, so not stabilized by some symmetry, will decay through the Higgs portal or through interactions with twin weak interactions, say to twin neutrinos if they're light enough. Now, the decay timescales of these things will depend on the UV completion of your model, what high dimensional operators you've got, what other states are around. But there are reasons to think that they might have long enough lifetimes to be cosmologically interesting. So, for example, if we've got some link between twin baryon number and standard model baryon number, then we might have decay operators of the form three twin quarks, three standard model quarks, whatever, which necessarily of high dimension and with reasonable kind of scaling interaction scales, the possibility of long lifetimes. Again, the question of whether you actually have long enough lifetimes to be cosmologically stable, UV dependent. Okay, so looking at the thermal history of these things, assuming that we do have these things living long enough to be interesting. So the Higgs portal interactions, which are determined just by this F over V, so the ratio of the BEVs, mean that the standard model and the twin sector are in thermal equilibrium until temperatures which are well below the cutoff. So we know that we're going to have a thermal freeze-out scenario. We have thermal equilibrium at a temperature where things are under control. So looking first at the twin baryon states, those are strongly interacting, unsurprisingly, annihilate pretty fast. In particular, they're going to, unless these things are very heavy, which doesn't make sense given the numbers we've got, their numbers will be well below the dark matter abundance. So if there's not an asymmetry, then they annihilate fast enough. The symmetric component is very small.
That's what the same reason the usual baryons.
Yes, the same reason that standard model baryons, if you didn't have a baryon asymmetry, wouldn't be any relevant abundance today.
There's a couple of primes on those G's, right?
Yes, there's those two primes on those G's. Okay, so those are the twin baryons. With the twin leptons, those will annihilate via twin weak interactions and also via the Higgs portal for the standard model. And for basically the same reasons that you have the WIMP miracle in standard model extensions, you get or ballpark the right kind of cross sections to give you a symmetric dark matter abundance from these. So if this is the mass of the twin lepton, this is the abundance relative to the dark matter abundance. So, and these are different values for the ratio of the VEVs. So if we take, as we take the VEV higher, we need a higher amount to actually get dark matter abundance. So yeah, as the 100 GeV or so range, give or take, we get a symmetry, you get the right abundance to be symmetric dark matter. Lighter than that, and we have overproduction. So that in particular, even if we're not looking for dark matter from these models, if we have too light a twin lepton, then you're going to have a lot of that hanging around. That's dangerous. Okay, and so the twin neutrino, if it gets a heavy Dirac mass, it'll just behave like the twin tau. That's just a difference in labeling. Again, we get a twin WIMP style scenario. If it's much lighter and it's got a mass of larger than a few EV, then the abundance, like the twin tau, will be too large. We're going to have larger than dark matter density. So we either need to have it that it's got a sort of, so it's got a mass of less than a few EV, like standard model neutrinos, so it's a dark radiation component, and we'll come back to the magnitude of that later, Or we need that it's heavy enough that we get a sub-dark, a dark matter or sub-dark matter abundance. Yeah, and like I said, we'll come back to the constraints on if it's dark, if it's light enough to be dark radiation later. Yeah?
I'm just reading.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll read the same. So are these the different options?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is another situation. So far you've discussed how many... Can you
have delta?
Yes, so we have...
Delta will have to be asymmetric.
Yes.
Power prime will have to be symmetric.
Yeah.
But not too heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have twin baryons, delta prime, so that'll be asymmetric if it's dark matter. We've got we have the twin leptons, then that's around 100 GeV or so. That gives you symmetric dark matter. If we have our twin neutrinos, then either those are also heavy and you basically just have a labeling issue between these and the tau primes. Or, so either the same, or their light and their dark radiation.
Okay.
So that's the sort of split. So we get pretty much like, similar to the standard model, as you'd expect since we're mirroring the standard model. Okay, so the obvious symmetric dark matter candidate is the twin lepton. So would we be able to see this? And, well, the interaction that it has with standard model stuff is via the Higgs portal. So we do have direct detection signatures from scattering with standard model nuclei via Higgs exchange. So plotting out the signal we expect here, so here's the mass of our twin lepton. Here's the cross-section with standard model nucleons. So for the minimum value of... The cutoff allowed, so the minimum tuning, you're actually pretty close to current limits and well within the range of near future things. As you take the tuning higher, so 10% tuning gets you to the sort of edge of the next generation of things, 1% tuning takes you further down, but still not well outside the range of plausible experiments. So the takeaway from this is that if we're going to have twin lepton dark matter, it's pretty clearly, with less than 1% tuning, visible in projected experiments with direct detection through the Higgs portal interaction, which has to be there from the structure of the theory. Okay, so that's direct detection. There's also, since it's symmetric dark matter, the possibility of indirect detection. So the dominant annihilation channel, if you have light enough B quarks, so if you have, M tau prime greater than.
So I don't understand why you don't have such signals also for the baryons?
The symmetric population of those is just very low.
Because they really
low. Yeah.
But you want to be dark matter,
no? Okay, so but what we're saying is that the baryons couldn't be dark matter without being asymmetric.
Yes, it makes me asymmetric, but you still have why don't you have
Oh no, but you don't have annihilation signals if it's asymmetric.
No, indirect detection.
Oh, we'll come back to that later. So we're looking at the symmetric. So yes, we'll look at the symmetric case at first. Then
we have
we'll
exactly the same diagrams for the slide before for the symmetric.
Yeah.
The symmetric case.
Okay, that's just a slide ordering issue. We'll come to that slide in a few slides' time. That will happen. It will happen. Okay, but okay. So on the symmetric dark matter side. So if we have symmetric twin lepton dark matter, then we're going to have indirect detection signals from annihilation of this. If the twin bottom quark is lightish, then the dominant annihilation channel will be to that. So we'll have these things going to twin bottom quarks, which will then go through the twin hadronization process, messy crap. So the twin glue balls and mesons, whatever, those we expect to decay eventually to the standard model through the Higgs portal or to twin neutrinos through twin weak interactions, depending, and so we expect to get some level of standard model injection through the Higgs portal.
That depends a lot on how does it depend on the mass relation between B prime and tau prime?
So, yeah, so we need, obviously you need that MB prime is less than the mass of tau prime.
Yeah, so you need, yeah.
Well, no, I'm not necessarily, right? You can just do it off shell.
Yeah.
But then it's then
yes, then your dominant annihilation channel will probably, well, if your twin neutrinos are lighter, will be to the twin neutrinos,
yes.
You won't get such a signal there. So yeah, so this is not necessarily going to be there.
Yeah.
This is basically the strongest standard model signal you'd get. If you change the masses around, you can get rid of the signal by making it mostly go to twin neutrinos or whatever.
Yeah.
But the strongest type of signal will be if it hadronizes and then these twin globules, whatever, decay to standard model stuff through the Higgs portal. And in that case, you would produce the usual kind of annihilation signals for stuff in the sort of 100 GeV range.
Yeah.
With slightly different, you have some higher multiplicity final state, you get a slightly softer spectrum, you have other channels through the twin stuff, so you generally get slightly lower signals than the standard WIMP straight to standard model annihilation scenario. So you are safe from current constraints and the kind of mass range you're at, but again, with low-ish tuning, you're potentially within the range of future observations. Not necessarily dependent, you can change the masses around, change the branching ratios, things will change. Okay, and there's also this is not necessarily the generic case, but a slightly sort of cute thing. If the twin neutrinos have a heavy enough mass, then some of the globules might be long-lived due to selection rules. It takes them a long time to decay through the scalar Higgs portal. And if these have the lifetime between a few seconds and about the distance from the Sun to the Earth, so about 1,000 seconds or so, then if you have dark matter annihilation in the center of the Sun, then these could, I think you wrote papers on this. Then yes, you could get these to decay outside the Sun. Yeah, it's a nice cute thing. And it'd be a very striking kind of signal. So you get gamma rays, potentially antiprotons as well, which don't seem to have been actually done an analysis of. Fermi has done an analysis of this in gamma rays. It seemed a little.
There was different, like the theory curve, which I'm not even how to put the theory curve. Yeah, it looks like this, and but the data looks like this.
Yeah.
Okay. So no, it will be interesting to see. And this is not just this model. There are many more models where you have long-lived annihilation products. It would be interesting to see whether there was some analysis of cosmic rays as well.
Nice,
that would be an interesting thing to look at. And if the gamma ray analysis isn't so good, then I say yeah.
To have a signal from the sun, you need to have enough scattering or capture rate, right? But your scattering is off the
Higgs
portal.
So the point is that you continue accumulating stuff in the center of the sun until the annihilation rate equals the capture rate.
Yeah, but the capture rate is
the same as the scattering. It doesn't need as much annihilation rate as normal direct detection.
Yeah.
Because normal things is dark matter that captures the annihilating into neutrinos.
Mm-hmm.
And there you need a huge flux to see that.
Yeah.
But here you don't need much of a flux to see it because you're going to gamma.
So you do need to work out the numbers, but it turns out that it's not ludicrous. You can get reasonable signals from the kind of annihilation scattering rates that you get. But yeah, no, you do need to work out the numbers, but it turns out that it's reasonably plausible in the case where your annihilation products do have long enough lifetimes. They're metastable over the right time scale. Okay. Right, so coming back, so that was the symmetric dark matter case. So onto the asymmetric case. So the general idea with asymmetric dark matter, so exactly like in the case of standard model baryons, we have that we annihilate efficiently enough that we get rid of the symmetric component, the particle antiparticle component, but we originally have a few more particles than antiparticles. So we're left with some residual abundance of particles which carries on to be our dark matter. And the sort of model building hope for this is that if we had some kind of model that generated roughly comparable asymmetries and roughly comparable masses for standard model baryons and whatever the dark matter is, then the fact that the ratio of dark matter to baryons in our universe is about 5-ish or so, but not too crazily different, might drop out from that. That's something that drives quite a lot of asymmetric dark matter model building. Okay, so here we'll ignore this part of the question, actually generating asymmetries. That is for us a UV question, which is interesting once you extend the model, but future work, whatever. So we'll look at assuming that the appropriate asymmetries are generated that would give us this ratio. We'll see if the twin baryons can be a successful dark matter candidate, and they automatically are going to turn out to have a mass in the right range. Okay, so going over the asymmetry structure. So like we said earlier, we have twin baryon, lepton, charge, quantum numbers in the simplest version of the model. If we could have asymmetries in lepton number and charge that led to an asymmetric abundance of the twin leptons, but to get those to annihilate fast enough, we need the mass to be pretty large. You could look at that region, we're not going to. So, like I said earlier, we're going to look at the twin baryon population, which has a fast annihilation rate because they're strongly interacting with each other. So we get rid of the symmetric component efficiently and are left with only the asymmetric part. And because the twin QCD had to have roughly the same coupling at the cutoff scale as the standard model QCD had, the confinement scale, like I said, had to be in this range of sort of few GeV-ish. So if the twin bottom quark mass is less than of all of the confinement scale, then the baryon mass, like for the standard model, is set by the confinement scale. So we automatically have a motivated mass range for this twin baryon state between sort of a few GeV and tens of GeV, which is potentially interesting. Okay, so the next question is, well, what form will this stuff be in today? So standard model baryons actually do really complicated stuff. They start off just being neutrons and protons floating about, but then you have nuclear synthesis, molecules happen, people happen, it's all very complicated. Here, it's a bit simpler. So even if you do actually have bound states in the twin QCD spectrum, the light states that you'd actually be able to de-excite to form those will generally be the twin neutrinos or standard model stuff. And you're too weakly coupled to both to actually get any significant fusion rates in the early universe. So the vast majority of the relic twin baryons that you'll see today will be freely floating. They won't have had a chance to actually combine, even if they could. So that's simple enough. Okay, so the next question is, well, these things are strongly interacting, so how do they scatter off each other? So they have a cross-section per unit mass, which is set by, very roughly parametrically, the confinement scale. The usual bound on elastic dark matter scattering is about 1 bar per GeV or so. So that is standard model nucleon cross-sections. These things are a bit heavier, so that means that the self-interaction cross-sections will generally be smaller per unit mass. So those so they will generically be safe from your naive self-interaction bounds, being a bit heavier than standard model stuff. Okay, so as you asked for, the direct detection consequences. Again, we have Higgs portal interactions necessarily there, so we're going to have direct detection, we're going to have scattering of these things off standard model nuclei. So that can happen via Higgs exchange, or exchange of some twin meson global thing that mixes with the standard model Higgs. So that makes it slightly harder to calculate this properly. And actually working out what the coupling of this twin baryon state is. This is a complicated state. You'd actually need to do lattice computations or whatever to work out what its form factors are and all that. But we can get some band of plausible cross-sections that we're in, and you are, for masses which are larger than sort of 10-ish GeV, within the realm of future experiments.
Can you explain the different labels? What is chi hat?
So this is if you're taking a particular limit in an estimate for what this cross-section should be. So just look at the green shaded area. This is roughly where it would be. The other lines are there because I didn't have time to rub them out.
Okay. But what is happening there?
I should have taken them out.
Imagine you're a yellow blind.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Just imagine that it's not there for the moment. Yeah. That's a particular estimate which is somewhere in the middle. This is the biggest estimate and Anyway.
This is the uncertainty that comes because you take a range of the global and
yes. And a range of what the coupling of the glue balls to this baryon state is, and all that.
I see. So you get this green map.
Exactly. That's the idea. So the point is, it's quite big. You might have signals, you might not have signals.
I have signals too.
Yes, it's quite big. But there is a reasonably large region up here at the slightly higher mass range where you might well have signals. That's the general idea there. Okay. There's. No, so this side of the plot is basically, yeah, ignore that. Yeah, that's it doesn't come out very well here, but basically ignore that side of it.
Okay.
Yeah, half-ish, under some kind of... Okay, and then another little bit of phenomenology. If we go back and actually put in a gauged U1 prime, if we actually do put in a twin dark, a dark photon here, then we need to have the universe be charge neutral. So we're going to need equal abundances of our twin baryon and our twin tau, I think. Yep.
That I don't see how is it possible. I mean, won't you be excluded by an effective? Because you're in thermal equilibrium with the star hole.
You're in thermal equilibrium until a certain point.
Right.
It turns out that you come out of equilibrium soon enough that your temperature is low enough that you're not quite excluded.
So when the standard model reheats,
yes.
Your standard model,
the CMB is at a high temperature, mm-hmm. high enough that you'll be okay for values of the parameter range.
Do you need really massless? Is this thing
Sorry?
This thing really massless?
Yes. Yeah.
So why doesn't your dark matter pancake like the disks
do? Oh no, so this is the point here. So this is only viable because these you have require equal abundances of these in order to get charge neutrality. And then these things attract each other, positive, negative, so you can form dark atoms.
Do you form
them? And so, yeah, so this is the point. And if they don't, then certainly the dark matter is far too strongly self-interacting. Things don't look anything like they do normally. So you do actually need it to be overall neutral. So imposing that constraint, you have to have that the dark atoms successfully form. You need to get successful dark recombination going, which means you've got to be above this blue line here. This is the mass of the dark atom. This is the twin electromagnetic coupling. And
I guess I'm not sure why that helps. I mean, in the sense that if I had just a cloud of neutral hydrogen collapsing, the main thing that makes this happen is that you have some sort of a channel in which you dissipate energy. So as the stuff falls in, it can radiate it away. Because you have massless state there to radiate it into.
Yes, so you do need... You do need to be a bit careful with that, but if you don't have many collisions happening in the first place in order to actually radiate away the energy, then only a small fraction of the dark matter is actually going to lose energy. Most of it is just going to carry on its way. So that's this self-interaction bound, as in if you're average dark matter particle never hits another one, never actually has an opportunity to collide and lose energy via a dark photon, then it doesn't matter if it could lose energy because it doesn't.
So there's one thing that helps you here is that your dark atoms are much smaller than normal ones.
Exactly. That's the trick. They're small. They're much smaller, and the probability that they ever hit another one is less.
How big are they?
So that's set by the mass. That's parametrically set by the kind of mass here. So if you're at the range where hydrogen is 10 GeV or so, then it's sufficiently small enough if you're in this range here. So as alpha gets smaller, these things get bigger because they're more spread out. That's bad here. But if your alpha is sufficiently high and your mass is sufficiently high, then up here, you're safe. So in this top part of the graph, you're potentially safe from both of those things. And you can have a scenario where dark matter is just these dark atoms, which are small enough that they, on a good approximation, never hit each other in the lifetime of the galaxy, and are neutral, so just carry on going around.
What is the mass between tau? What are you assuming for the tau time?
So you're assuming the ratio between these is 1 in this plot.
Ah, okay.
So you can also look at what happens if you change that ratio, and it'll change the numbers a bit. But yeah. But it looks as though there is some viable parameter range up in the higher mass region where you could actually have these things existing. Of course, yeah. No, there are separate plots. I should have put those in the backup. We can get those up later. Okay. So other possible physics of this kind of scenario. So before dark recombination, these things are a plasma, so they have acoustic oscillations in the same way. But as long as these acoustic oscillations stop early enough, as long as you recombine early enough, then these are not observationally significant. They're not excluded. Might you actually form molecules in these things? Well, it turns out that you basically need an abundance of charged of ions to catalyze molecule formation. And in the standard model, that's you get the reionization of the universe, you have some population of ions hanging around, happens via that. Here, it doesn't seem to be a suitable parameter space for it. You get some kind of form factor, because the effective size of these atoms can be in the lower mass range, about the size of standard model nuclei, nothing too spectacular. Okay, so a few little bits of physics there. Okay, so to round this off, looking at a few other features of the cosmology of these kind of models. So we've considered the phenomenology of just the dark matter candidate species so far. So other aspects are the dynamics of the phase transitions that we might go through to get there, and also, like I said earlier, the possibility of having some dark radiation around, and whether or not that's constrained by bounds on NF. Okay. So looking at the phase transition stuff first. So we'll look at the twin QCD phase transition here. The twin electroweak phase transition, that depends on what's happening with your UV completion in our terms. So we'll just look at the twin QCD phase transition when things are under control. Okay, so this is the standard plot of how things go for QCD. This is, so you have two quarks with this mass, and then one quark with mass given by this. So if all the quarks are infinitely heavy, so we're in zero flavor, pure QCD, you have a first order phase transition. If you're at the physical point where you have two lightish ones and one strange quark which is kind of intermediate, somewhere around, not too far from the confinement scale, then you get a crossover. If you're down here, you're first order again. So if we are, in our case, we'd be on this line where we have only one effectively light flavor. So because the top is very heavy, the twin top is very heavy, and the twin bottom is either heavier or lighter, so we'd be going between either no light quarks or one light quark. So if we're in the case where the twin bottom is sufficiently heavier than the confinement scale, we could have a first order phase transition. And the question is, well, does that have important cosmological consequences? Do we get entropy production? Do we get gravitational radiation? Do we need to worry about it? Yes, that is, okay, we can call that a sort of UV-dependent question, in that that does matter. For example, so we drew out the...
Oh, because it's so close to the gap.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You do need to worry about the UV completion at that stage. Whereas the twin QCD thing, this is well into the effective field theory range.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, thinking about what could happen at the twin electroweak phase transition is interesting, but you need to worry about other details. Okay, so in a situation where we could get a first order phase transition, it turns out that for pure gauge QCD, so for no light quarks, the phase transition is first order, but it's fairly weakly first order. So here's the entropy density compared to temperature cubed as a function of temperature compared to critical temperature. So this is the critical temperature. So this is the confined phase. This is the unconfined phase. So you have, it goes there, it jumps at this stage, but then most of the transition is fairly smooth. The jump is actually fairly small. It's fairly weakly first order. And if you look at the pressure, then this is a jump. This is a discontinuity. This is a derivative discontinuity. But again, it's a fairly small one. So the dynamics of the phase transition will be that you're cooling down until you get to the critical temperature. You will then supercool a little bit below that, so carry on going down here, until you've reached a sufficiently low temperature that you can actually form a critical bubble of the confined phase. So until the pressure difference is big enough that a bubble of confined phase has enough pressure to overcome the surface tension cost and to expand and then take over space. So from NASA's studies, people have looked at this. You have that the latent heat of this transition is whatever. The surface tension is pretty small in units of the critical temperature. And so you work out what the pre-energy cost of a critical bubble is. So a critical bubble is just big enough that as we make it bigger, the free energy goes down, so it's light, so it wants to expand. So that turns out to be a pretty small number times this times delta, where the delta is T is 1 minus delta Tc times Tc. Okay? So then the rate of bubble nucleation, the unit volume, given roughly by e to the minus delta free energy over t. So you put all that together, and it turns out that we want our delta to be about q times 10 to the minus 4. The upshot of that is basically because this latent heat was fairly small and the surface tension was fairly small, we only need a very small supercooling before we actually start nucleating bubbles fast. And because it's exponential, once we go to lower temperature than that, we start nucleating very fast.
And how would you know that this happened?
In what sense?
How would you observe such a thing?
Oh, no, we can't. No, the point is actually it's not going to be observable, sadly. But
okay.
This is showing that you can't. No, so, for example, some people have claimed that you could.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the point.
Ah, okay.
But sadly, you can't. Okay. No. No. Okay, so the point is that, yeah, so the transition... sadly, no. So because we only have to supercool a very little bit, the transition completes very fast. So either the nucleation occurs everywhere at once, or you have your bubble of... So we create a bubble of confined phase. It expands. It then heats up the unconfined phase outside it until we're back at Tc, and then we slowly adiabatically expand as Hubble expansion removes energy from the mixture. The general point is that the outer equilibrium process is occurring at a temperature which is only very slightly below the critical temperature. So there's only ever a small pressure difference, so we can only ever produce a small amount of entropy, which is parameterized by this delta here, so about 10 to the minus 3 Tc. So there's no significant entropy production from this thing. And that's actually an upper limit. It's probably much smaller delta squared. And in this case, the most likely case where it is mostly adiabatic, so you bubble expands a bit, heats it up, and then you're at the critical temperature throughout, roughly, there you don't have any fast out of equilibrium dynamics, so the gravitational radiation production is extremely small. Mm-hmm. That looks to be the most likely case, and there it's a very gentle process, and basically no prospect of seeing anything. So there we go. So the conclusion is that it's not interesting, but dynamics of phase transitions are interesting, sort of. Okay, so moving on to the dark radiation issue. So if the, like I said earlier, if the twin neutrinos are lighter than the sort of 100 GeV-ish scale, then they need to be all the way to about few MeV, like standard model neutrinos, in order not to have too high a density. And there, they would form a dark radiation abundance. And the energy density of this depends on when it decouples from the standard model, so what temperature it's at. So if it decouples from the standard model after the twin QCT phase transition, so and it, assuming that the twin neutrinos are the only twin sector states which are lighter than the twin strong states, then so we have, at that point, standard model is just before the standard model QCT phase transition, so it has quite a lot of degrees of freedom. So we can work out what the temperature of these are. So it's about the standard model neutrinos end up about twice as hot as the twin neutrinos. So we end up with a pretty small delta and F contribution. Much smaller than the current sensitivity. Not actually about the same level as the possible sort of future sensitivity with a proper all-sky polarization mission or whatever. So you do have a potential irreducible contribution, which is visible but not in the near future. That was if it decoupled before the twin QCD phase transition. After the twin QCD phase transition. If it decouples before the twin QCD phase transition, then you have, you have the standard model with all its gluons and quarks, but you also have the twin sector, which also has all of its gluons, so twin gluons and things. So you have quite a lot of entropy here, and if they're decoupled, this will all end up in the twin neutrinos, or can all end up in the twin neutrinos, and that could mean you get a delta MNF contribution of up to 2. So in that case, that is well outside the allowed bounds. So what we require is that the interactions are strong enough that this doesn't happen, that you actually do manage to get most of the entropy from the twin glue bath into the standard model. And if you look at the scaling, it turns out that this means you want larger twin confinement scales. Works out that makes it better compared to Hubble. So this places an approximate lower bound on the twin confinement scale in order to actually get sufficiently low delta NF. But also interpolating, you can have delta NF at some kind of visible value by having it in between. Okay, so that's pretty much.
That corresponds to what she
doesn't know. So the G difference was about, the allowable difference was about 15% or so.
Yeah.
So this is probably a difference of 5% or so. I need to check exactly what the scaling is, a few percent.
Okay,
so that's pretty much it. So just to give a quick summary of what we've gone through. So twin Higgs theories are an example of a sort of neutral naturalness paradigm, trying to solve the little hierarchy problem without introducing new standard model charged states. So getting around the fact that we haven't seen any new standard model charged states. And in these kind of models, we might have accidental or gauge symmetries, which give rise to cosmological stable twin states. And we've looked at a couple of dark matter candidates. Twin leptons, which because they're interacting by twin weak interactions, which are related to standard model weak interactions by the symmetry requirements for cancellation, can have a twin wimp miracle, getting dark matter abundances for sort of 100 GeV scale-ish. There's also the possibility of a asymmetric dark matter coming from twin baryons with a mass scale, which is related by twin QCD, and is related by that to be reasonably small factor larger than standard model baryons, which gives potentially interesting and at least viable phenomenology. And then there's also the possibility of, if you have light states in these models, getting a dark radiation abundance, which is potentially testable and also imposes constraints on the model not to be too large. And then as people were saying throughout, there are lots and lots, this is a very minimal, it's a particular kind of minimal twin Higgs model. There are lots of other ways in which you can go, and they also have lots of interesting phenomenology. Okay, so thanks very much. Any questions?
Yeah, I have two questions.
Sure.
The first is, could you comment on the possibility of an effective constraints in the scenario where you have a twin photon?
Do I have those numbers to mind? Okay, so the question is, at what point do we go out of equilibrium with the standard model? So at what temperature the twin photon ends up? Happens. In the minimal case, this is going to happen when we only have the Higgs-Portal interactions. So it's going to happen when the lightest things that have Higgs-Portal interactions with the standard model, so standard model and then twin stuff. So, for example, when we have these, the lightest ones of those get Boltzmann with a reasonable Yukawa coupling, get Boltzmann suppressed enough. Okay, no, I don't have any numbers off the top of my head, but if you, you get numbers which are not so far off those things, as in.
Yeah. Just because I might expect an entropy dump from your dark matter or whatever it is that's annihilating to these twin photons into the twin photon sector, which would substantially boost the concentration.
Yeah. I mean, that is what's happening in this case. We get an entropy dump from the twin gluon bath into the twin neutrinos. So in this kind of case, yes, we get an entropy dump from whatever the last thing to keep us in equilibrium with the standard model was into the twin photons. No, I'd need to look up the numbers on that. And I can't remember exactly what the fiber parameter space is. But yeah, you do need to go through those numbers.
And my second question was, have you considered a sort of folded Soucy equivalent scenario?
As in trying to looking at UV completions or looking at?
No, there's the other neutral naturalness where cancel with the twin stop.
Yes.
Right.
So you don't have, so which ones? So yeah, so we've got that this is not, so it's not colored. So the partner is not colored and it's, it is fully neutral then.
Yeah, it's standard model neutral.
Thermal neutral.
I was just wondering if you thought.
No, so we haven't thought about folders, yes. Yeah, any other questions?
So at the beginning, you motivated it by a naturalness, and then people gave you a hard time about the various tokens that had happened.
Yes.
Yeah. How much of that was driven by the minimalness of your assumptions? Or in this class of models, what's the best case scenario?
Well, so the only thing that's definitely a tuning is the fact that we've got to tune the. Let's get the hockey stick again. We've got to tune the A sector to have a smaller bear from the B sector, so we've got to move this up to here. So the rest of the features, which people were worrying about, that we are breaking the symmetry by, say, not having a second and third generation related in the same way that our T and B generation is, that's hard to quantify. I mean, there might be some model where it actually comes out perfectly natural that this generation is special, and that this is where the symmetry applies, and the other generations are different. People have tried to do these kind of things. I mean, I wouldn't call anything completely convincing yet, but this is the tuning that it's easy to quantify as something that's, pretty clearly a tuning at the level of the effective fit theory that we're looking at. The rest of it is a question of, can you find other models that actually give you the symmetry structure in a natural, in a plausible way? And the answer is, to be honest, looks a bit difficult, but.
There's time.
Okay.
Robert, there are no more questions.
Oh, thank you.